If you have your Bible, you'll open with me to Genesis chapter 1. This morning we'll be reading verses 26 through 31. Genesis chapter 1. And if you're using the Bible in the seats in front of you, it'll be found on page 1. Genesis chapter 1, beginning in verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth and to every bird of the heavens and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This is our title banner for the whole first chapter of Genesis. The earth was formless and void. There was only darkness over the face of the deep. But the Spirit of God was hovering over the darkness in the face of the waters. God the Father was presiding over the act of creation. John 1, Colossians 1, Hebrews 1 all tell us that it was through God the Son that everything was created. Everything was created by him and for him. And here in just the second verse of Genesis, we find God the Spirit active as well in the creating of the cosmos. In the chaos of formlessness and emptiness, the triune God comes. He comes into that chaos to create order and harmony. He comes into the chaos to bring fullness and purpose where there was none before. And as we move through the 7 days of creation listed here in Genesis 1, we discover that even though all matter had a beginning, and even though all matter had its origin in God, the days of creation, as described here, are not about material production, but they are about assigning function. So days 1 through 3 address the problem of formlessness by assigning structure and boundaries. Days 4 through 6 address the void. They address the problem of emptiness by filling the newly fashioned structures with the sun, the moon, the stars, birds, fish, and every kind of animal, livestock, creeping things, and wild beasts of all kinds. So the stage has been set. The garden has been prepared. The world awaits its occupants. It's as if the entire magnificent house has been built solid and beautiful, filled and decorated with the finest of furnishings. The landscaping is complete, the balance, the vivid colors, and the floral aromas strike the senses. And it all stands ready for the climactic event of the verses from our text today. Man is created, man as male and female moves into the house. And there are indicators in the text that we have ascended to the summit of Genesis chapter 1. You'll notice in verse 26 that a shift occurs in the narrative from third person to first person plural. And that tells us that here we are allowed in to the internal dialogue of the Godhead. The Father, the Son, and the Spirit deliberate among themselves concerning the creation of man, and their will is expressed in these words: let's make man in our image and in our likeness, and let's give them dominion over all the rest of creation. And so, verse 27, we find the very first poem in the Bible announcing the point, the climax, the pinnacle of creation: man created in the image of God as male and female. Which, by the way, off to the side, tells us that sex and everything related to it, from all those tingly emotions to the physical equipment that we have, the differentiation of the sexes, all of that was God's idea. He's Lord over sexuality because it was his idea. Now, when intruders come along and sown a lot of lies about that area and seeks to rob God of the glory that he deserves in these kinds of intimacies, but it's all God's idea. He creates man in his image. He creates him as male and female. And then this raises one of the most profound theological questions of all time, which is, what does it mean to be created in the image of God? And do you really believe that that's true of you, that you are created in the image of God? What does it mean? Well, this is where all of our groundwork in Genesis 1 to this point comes to bear. Because at this point in the narrative, we're not talking about the mere production of human beings or the matter with which they are composed. But as with the rest of Genesis 1, we are seeing God in these verses assign function. Now, you may have never read it this way before in your life, but this is really crucial to get the point of the author. He's assigning function. The focus is not on method. These verses are not answering the question, how did God make man? We want to argue about all of that, but that's not the point of these verses. These verses are answering the question, how has God made us to function? What role are we assigned in the cosmos? It's not dealing with method and how we were created. It's really dealing with the broader question of the reason why we were created. And this is a massive issue. If you get this one wrong, then all the rest of life falls apart. If you miss the point of the Creator, it all falls apart. You miss the reason for your existence. You miss the purpose of your life if you miss this one. In 1933, Ernest Hemingway wrote a short story entitled A Clean, Well-Lighted Place. I remember asking my literature teacher in high school during our dialogue on the writings of Hemingway, why are we looking for the key to satisfaction in life in the writings of a man who took his own life? It didn't make sense to me. I didn't understand. This guy ended his life, and now we look at his writings to try to find the key to understanding life. But we give the gifted Hemingway this much: when you take away the biblical God from your worldview, there is nothing satisfying to live for any longer. There is not another answer to the human dilemma of emptiness when you miss the message of Genesis 1. A Clean, Well-Lighted Place is about a drunk, deaf man sitting in a diner late at night with two waiters sharing their observations about this man's pathetic condition. He had recently tried to take his own life, tried to kill himself. His niece found him and cut him loose from the noose before he died. And now he sits in this diner late at night, drinking his life away, calling for more and more brandy. And the final conclusion of The Last Waiter is put into these words by Hemingway. It was all a nothing, and a man was a nothing too. Our nada, who art in nada, nada be thy name. Thy kingdom nada, thy will be nada in nada as it is in nada. Give us this nada, our daily nada, and nada us as we nada our nadas, and nada us not into nada, but deliver us from nada. Hail nothing, full of nothing, nothing is with thee. This is the waiter's conclusion as he observes this man in all of his despair. And John Walton writes, people today are more likely to agree with Hemingway's assessment that life was all a nothing and a man was nothing too. And that people are therefore no more than an accident suspended between accidents, birth and death. Limited by material, they have no sense of the eternal. This is the world we live in. And its philosophy runs contrary to the biblical view, where people are created with functions and purpose. We can do, he says, no greater damage to humanity than to rob it of purposeful existence. There is no dignity in being at the top of the evolutionary ladder. We can do no greater damage to biblical theology than to compromise God's purposeful creation of human beings. We need to communicate that what is at issue is not the specifics of evolution versus the specifics of Genesis and which one's right, but rather at issue is the worldview claim that life is the product of impersonal forces versus the claim that life was designed by an intelligent agent. We have to fight worldview with worldview. In creation theology, ordaining purpose is biblically more central than the making of things. Yet too often we have allowed the creation-evolution debate to be staged as if the main issue is the origin of things. We should rather focus on the meaning and purpose of cosmic and human existence. Why are we even here? Just think of what he says. We can do no greater damage to humanity than to rob it of its purposeful existence. Then all you end up with is nada, 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 hail nothing, nothing is with thee, nothing, nothing, it's all chasing after the wind. Mystery writer Nevada Barr learned this truth the hard way after returning to faith from her long sojourn on the wild side. She concluded, quote, "It was a number of years of crashing and burning before I made the discovery that I was not God. Finally, I realized that though I was not God, I was of God." It's a really big distinction. And it gets to the heart of purpose. I'm not God. I come into the world with this bent, this heart that's bent in on itself. And I want to live as if I were God. And you don't have to teach babies this. They live like they are the center of the universe, as cute as they are. They come in with this predisposition to complete self-absorption. But to the ones who are wise, to the ones who are keeping their eyes and their hearts and minds open to what God is doing, you come to realize early on, I am not God, but I am of God. So rather than speculate about all the things that being made in the image of God could mean in detail, and you can find all kinds of books on that, let me just summarize for us this morning the essence into two words of this text and its implication for our lives. Two words, and the two words are these: dignity and responsibility. As image bearers, men and women made in the image of God, dignity and responsibility. That great Minnesotan poet, Bob Dylan, sings, fat man looking at a blade of steel, thin man looking at his last meal, hollow man looking in a cotton field for dignity. Wise man looking in a blade of grass, young man looking in the shadows that pass, poor man looking through painted glass for dignity. Somebody got murdered on New Year's Eve. Somebody said dignity was the first to leave. I went into the city, went into the town, went into the land of the midnight sun, searching high, searching low, searching everywhere I know, asking the cops wherever I go, have you seen dignity? John Walton said, people today, human dignity impacts how we look at other people today. Your view of dignity changes all of that. Since all people are made in the image of God, all deserve to be treated with the dignity that that image affords. This belief will affect our view of how society responds to human needs, how we respond to people who are sick or imprisoned or bereaved or poverty-stricken or defenseless. If you believe that they are created in the image of God, that they bear His image, that they have greater worth than all the combined wealth of the world, regardless of their production or their intellectual capacity or their age on this side of the life spectrum or on this side of the life spectrum. But if you believe that human life is different than believing that all things, animals and trees and people, all have equal worth, this is not biblical to talk this way, and it changes everything. To say that we uniquely are created as the pinnacle of God's creation. As Christians, we can and should seek to shape the society around us in ways that will preserve human dignity, Walton says, but that will not always be possible in Western society. It's sometimes difficult to identify the path that upholds human dignity in a society that values rights above everything else and formulates everything in those terms. Not dignity, but rights. So we have the right to life. We have the right to choose. We have the right to be employed regardless of race or color. We have the right to equal treatment. We have the right to equal pay for equal work. And the list goes on and on. But how can dignity be preserved in the stampede of rights? Because when rights are granted grudgingly on theory or coerced through demands, dignity is lost from the equation. If we truly believe in the dignity of all things, rights and their protection follow automatically. When you get dignity, you get all the rights. When you try to enforce the rights against the will of people, you get a whole mess of society. If we truly believe in the dignity of all, rights and their protection follow automatically. The protection of rights is inevitable if preservation of dignity is valued, but it doesn't work the other way around. Preservation of dignity is not an inevitable result of the protection of rights. This explains a lot about our culture. If minority ethnic groups are treated with dignity, they will not have to wonder whether they've been given the job only because of rights issues. If women are treated with dignity in the workplace, they will not suffer degrading harassment. If we value the dignity of every human extending to the unborn child, we will have little defense for rights of sexual freedom or rights to choose the child's death. We live in a world of rights that has no sense of purpose. We live in a world of tolerance that has no sense of dignity for those tolerated. Or conscience concerning what is to be tolerated. We live in a world of leisure and squander it on empty pursuit. We live in a world of comfort and convenience where we can accumulate anything we want except that which matters most. The quest for human and humane attitudes and actions that go beyond legal rights must engulf the church. We are the image bearers. This is our purpose. To bring order to the chaos, to extend what God is doing in Genesis 1. It's why He put us here, to serve as His vice regents over all that He has created, and to extend that harmony, to speak into and commit ourselves to that dignity. We are to what? Love God with your whole heart. And then the second command is just like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Give dignity to others that you wish for yourself. These two things summarize the whole teaching of the Bible. We must value dignity higher than rights. Kent Hughes said, "Consider this. Even though you could travel 100 times the speed of light, even though you could travel past countless yellow-orange stars to the edge of the galaxy and swoop down to the fiery glow located a few hundred light years below the plane of the Milky Way, even though you could slow to examine the host of hot young stars luminous among the gas and dust, though you can observe close up the protostars poised to burst forth from their dusty cocoons, though you could witness a star's birth in all your stellar journeys, you would never see anything equal to the birth and wonder of a human being. For a tiny baby girl or boy is the apex of God's creation. But the greatest wonder of all is that the child is created in the image of God. The child once was not, and now, as a created soul, he or she is eternal. He or she will exist forever. And when the stars of the universe fade away, that soul shall live." The wonder of humanity created in the image of God. My daughter Lee and I just returned from this trip to Colombia yesterday. And the day that the whole trip wrapped up, we flew down last Sunday, and after we had the memorial service for Nola, and then flew back yesterday. And when everything wrapped up on our trip to Colombia on Friday, there were two life-changing events that took place. We got up in the morning, and we went to visit an orphanage. It was an orphanage that has been in existence for 70 years. They have placed over 8,000 children through this orphanage, and they had pictures of every one of them lining the hallways. And the place was filled with children, babies, little babies, like just like going up to the hospital and looking in an infant, you know, a new birth ward. There were just cribs all over with these little babies that had been abandoned. And there was an intensive care area for the ones that were, had to have oxygen and other kinds of care, and then we went to the place where they were eating in this little cafeteria area, and I was had my camera, and I was filming as I was kind of scanning like this, and there's a little boy that got this big smile on his face, and he's probably 4 or 5 years old, this big smile, he ran over, I'm trace going like this with the camera, and he ran right up to me and threw his arms around me, hugged me, and then the director of the orphanage told us the stories of the children, and it's almost... you feel like you're, the whole time you're there, you're just trying to keep yourself from crying. Because so many of them have been sexually abused for years by fathers. One boy kept in a cage like a dog for 3 years. Now he walks around, he looks at your iPad, and he just wants to play, and he's totally fascinated. And they love to see their picture taken and see their picture and be called by name. And you listen to them talk to each other, and they say, "Is that going to be your mommy?" And this one young girl ran up to me, and Leah introduced me as her father, and she said, will you adopt me? And we heard these children as they lined up, and they would tell their stories. The older ones, we saw these four girls at the orphanage, and they all wear their uniforms. It's a Catholic orphanage, and they're 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, the four girls. And they went down the line. They told us their name, and they told us their age, and then they told us where they would want to be adopted. And they all basically said the same thing. They said, "I would love to be adopted into the United States, but I want to be wherever God wants me to be." And then the fourth girl hung her head when she told us her name and her age, and she told us that she was 16 years old. And the reason that she was so crestfallen is that when you turn 16, you can no longer be adopted in the United States. So it's like she knew when she crossed that line, It's as if so much of her hope for a future and a family and a place where she could live and have needs met vanished along with it. But you realize when we are created in the image of God, when God gives us everything to be used for His purposes, we are the kind of people who have the capacity to love these children the way God has loved us in Jesus Christ. And there are all kinds of ways to do it. I mean, Heidi and I are going to host a child for 3 weeks in December, and we're going to bring 21 of those orphans up here in the hopes that there will be these families that host them, will advocate for them, and that the children will be adopted and find a home. This one girl that asked me if I would adopt her, by the way, she didn't know at the time, but she had been matched with a family in Texas, and she was told while we were there that this family, that everything had worked out, and she's going to grow up in Texas. Embraced by Grace, which is the group that we flew down there with, is they focus especially on children ages 5 to 15 because children in that age group are the least adoptable. Everybody wants, you know, brand new newborn, which is understandable, but these children long for love. Well, that was the morning. We went to two different orphanages, and just emotionally, you have a face now to poverty and a face to abandonment and a face to need and is crying out to be loved. And you just want to take them all home. But combine that then with what happened in the afternoon. We had to go. We visited these two orphanages, and then we had to get back to our plane. And I mentioned last week that we flew down in a private jet, and I'd never flown in a private jet before, you know, which means that there were probably eight of us or so in this jet, and you all sit close enough that I could reach out and touch each one of them. You can't stand up. You're all just kind of like this. And we flew all the way to Columbia that way. So we packed everything back in and got ready for the trip home, and you just feel so overwhelmed by all the emotions. And then we took off from the Bogota airport, and about 3 or 4 minutes into the flight, there was a loud pop. And immediately after the pop, air heated to 700 degrees began pouring into the cabin. Now, we're up above the clouds, and the pilot's looking back at me, and I'm going, oh, we can't breathe. It's just so hot. And immediately then, the walls of the cabin and the floor were just like an iron that you turned on to full blast. Things started melting, and then smoke started pouring into the cabin. I was okay till the smoke started pouring in, because I know what comes after the smoke. And once the fire comes, then we all explode, and we get to go right into glory, you know, right from the glory of the orphanage into the glories of heaven. Now we're all kind of messed up, you know, because it's so hot. And it's so smoky. And so some started to cry and started to pray. And then we dropped. It's like our free Tower of Terror ride. It's when we got to get this thing down. And you shot way down like this. And you just go, whoa. And then that moment, you're not praying, hail nothing. Nothing is nothing. There's nothing. You cry out to a God who made you and sustained you. And I'm thinking theology, but your theology goes through a test when this happens. And you're thinking, sparrow doesn't fall to the ground apart from the will of the Father. I belong to Him. I'm not my own. I've been bought with a price. He created me for His glory. He saved me by the blood of His Son for His purposes. I'm created in His image for Him. This is all the theology. You know, some people have their life past before them. It's like my theology was running by me when we were doing this. When we landed, we got back, finally. The whole thing was probably, you know, 10 or maybe 15 minutes at the most, but it just felt like the longest flight I'd ever been on. We landed, and I said, like, let's just get out of this thing right now. And we got out, and then they did some work, and they said, we think we found out what it is. We want everybody to get back in, and we're going to go. I said, well, let me talk about this now. You think you found out what it was? Pilot was a 77-year-old gentleman. He's flown presidents. I was told he's flown a third of the Hollywood stars. He flies all over the world for all the big dignitaries and stars. And he explained to me that there had been this, because the Bogota airport is so high that that the valves thought we were higher than we really were, and so this emergency valve kicked in, which normally when you're that high, it's 60 below zero, so it pumps all the hot air in. That's a good thing, and we really weren't in danger, but then all the smoke is in these pipes, and that gets into the cabin too, and we think that's what it was, and we think there's only a 20% chance it would happen again. So let's all get in and go home. And so some of us got in, and some of us didn't, and we took off. They said, if it happens again, it'll happen right away. And we'll just turn around and land, and we'll go home some other way. So a couple others flew home commercial, and the rest of us got in. But you know, then you fly home. You go out over the South Caribbean there, and you're flying over the water and watching the thunderstorms and the moon come up behind the thunderstorms and just processing all this. And you're just thinking, those children, just thinking, the glory of God, the whole earth is full of his glory. And then you think of these children, the image bearers of God, they are the pinnacle of his creation. And along with that sense of dignity of all human beings, as an image bearer, God gives us responsibility to now enjoy all that he has created, but we enjoy it as stewards, not as owners. When Heidi and I are gone for a long time, we always get Josh and Lindsay Williams to house sit for us. And when you house sit for someone, you get to use the whole house. You get to eat all the food. You get to run the remote. You get to do whatever you want. But you got to take the dog out, and you got to be careful because it's not your property. And when we come back, you know, if the whole place was ransacked or all wasted or the dog was dead or there's just, you know, you'd have questions, you know. And here we are. We live as vice regents under the authority of the sovereign, benevolent king, and we're supposed to use all that he has created for his purposes. That's the point. In contrast with the writings of the ancient Near East, because there, the creation accounts always involve creation moving out toward the gods. The gods need us, so we give them food. We try to appease them through all of our efforts. It's always about us trying to keep the gods happy. That's the way it was throughout all the ancient Near East. But when the Bible came along, when God began to reveal himself as he really was and speak in the language of people of that day, he contrasted all of that, and he told about himself designing and commissioning people to represent him in the world. We are to be his picture, his reflection, image him to the rest of the world by the way we live. So the way he has blessed us, we bless others. The way he has loved us, our purpose, our function, our calling for being here is to love other people the way he has loved us. That's why we're here. And if you don't know that, then you think instead that it's really about matter. It's really about stuff. It's really about, you know, your worth and your identity get defined by how much stuff you have and how much you can accumulate and how much you can give yourself comforts. And you forget that Jesus is our supreme model. He himself is the perfect image of the invisible God. Created in the image of God, but he perfectly reflects the image to us. He is our model. He is the one who shows us how to live happy, successful, satisfying lives. He's the model. And he had nothing. He didn't have any place to lay his head. So you can't be like the way I am by nature, where I think, you know, if I just had a little more time, oh, I could really spend time with God. I could pray. I could do all these good causes. Oh, if I just had more money. If I only had enough money, oh, then I could do all these great things, all this money. Well, shame on me when I think that way. Because the whole point of this text is to say, everything you have as you are right now, not as you want to be, not as you will be someday, but as you are today, what are you doing with what God has given you? The responsibility as an image bearer. Are you using all things like a steward for the purposes of God for which you were created? Because if you miss that, life isn't going to work and it's all going to fall apart. It's all going to leave you in the end, nothing, emptiness, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. And sometimes, you know, I find myself not wanting to look into the faces of the orphans of the world. Because it's like I know they're out there, but if I don't have to see them, then I don't have to worry about it. Who is my neighbor? What is truth? I can use all these philosophical questions to divert myself from connecting with these precious little image bearers around the world. But when you go see them and you hug them and you listen to their stories and you see how desperately they want to be loved because they were created for that, but they need someone to tell them this good news from Genesis, the gospel of Genesis. I just want to urge us to do that. I want us to think that way. I want us to think that way about ourselves. It's true. If you have a tendency to beat yourself up and think, oh, I'm just nothing, I'm no good, you turn into a doormat, you let people walk all over you, you know what? You need to understand you are the pinnacle of God's creation, that he has given you dignity, and there are some things that you should not tolerate, not because you're self-centered, but because you understand who you are from a biblical standpoint. But you also need to understand that as an image bearer, you were primarily created to image forth the qualities and attributes of God to the world. In other words, you were made like this for the good of other people. And if you don't recognize that and function in this way that God has assigned to you, to bring harmony and to bring hope and order to chaos, the chaos of the lives of, say, orphans in Colombia, these little kids. If you don't understand that, you get all this stuff to give out, then it just all backs up, and your life turns into a sewer that smells. That's what happens. This is the message of Genesis 1. And it puts us in this exalted position, but also with a sense of dependency upon the one who put us there, and a sense of responsibility to live for his glory, and to live according to the assignment he has given us. And faith means trusting him when he tells us that's what we're here to do. Saying, I really believe that I was put here to bless other people. A little further down in Genesis, we're going to see how God says to Abraham, Abraham, I'm going to bless all the peoples of the world through you. This whole theme of blessing, here God blesses them, right? He commissions them. He assigns them. He blesses them and says, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and rule over it as a vice regent under me. Continue my work of bringing order and harmony, hope and purpose to chaos and emptiness. Where is that happening in your life? Where would God call you to make a difference in that way? Let's pray. Lord, teach us to number our days so that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Bring us kind of right to the edge at times of life and even death to remind us how brief our lives are and how empty it is to live for temporal things. Open our eyes to the wonders of human life and its sacredness. Forgive us, Lord, for speaking harsh words of judgment and condemnation toward and about other image bearers. Forgive us anew this morning, Father, for thinking that the story, the narrative is all about us. Break our hearts where they need to be broken. Open our eyes to needs around us and around the world that we are equipped to meet in your name. Lord, give us open hearts and open homes. You've told us that pure, undefiled religion is this. It's visiting the widow and the orphan in their distress. So God, don't let us settle for anything but the pure stuff, the 100-proof. Give it to us, Father, and shake us up until we live that way, both so that we will know the pleasure, the joy, the fulfillment, the peace that comes from living according to how you have assigned our function in life and our purpose, but also so that you we'll get the glory that you deserve, reflected by the way we live, to those who need to come to know you personally. And Lord Jesus, thank you for reflecting the Father to us so perfectly, Thank you that all of your fullness gets transferred to our emptiness. And in you, we have salvation and everything we need. You are an amazing Messiah, Lord, and King. And therefore, we remember you and worship you together this morning. Amen.